This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. To some, Colin Kaepernick is a courageous black activist who's been blackballed by the NFL. Others see him as an ungrateful militant who's attacking the symbols of the nation. Where have we heard this sort of rhetoric before? Here's Only a Game, Shira Springer and Karen Given with a story that begins more than 45 years ago.
They met in secret, away from their white coaches and teammates.
We used to meet at midnight. We could have met earlier. But we used to meet at midnight to lay out our thoughts and plans, just like the slaves.
Dana Horrell was one of nine college football players the international media would incorrectly call the Syracuse Eight.
It was the late 1960s, after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and Bobby Kennedy. Dana and his black teammates didn't just see racial injustice, they lived it, and they wanted to do something about it.
The Syracuse Eight held some of their secret meetings on campus, but whenever they were hungry, they went to Ben's Kitchen. They were all working-class kids from inner cities, and they talked about their plans over plates of barbecue chicken, collard greens, and cornbread among the prostitutes and hustlers and the nightly craps game.
For the people of color in the city, that was the place, that was the joint.
That's Abdullah Alif Muhammad. Back then, he was known as Al Newton.
When all the other places closed, that's the place where you would go to get something to eat.
And trust me, there were no spies or infiltrators there.
At the time, Syracuse was a nationally prominent football program. Dana and his teammates had inherited the proud legacy of Jim Brown, one of the greatest football players of all time, and Ernie Davis.
Ernie Davis of Syracuse.
In 1961, Davis became the first African-American to win the Heisman Trophy.
The 21-year-old whiz kid is as hard to stop as a 10-ton truck. Watch that number 44.
Throughout the 1960s, Syracuse rode a wave of success, appearing in bowl games and filling the rosters of NFL teams. But the Syracuse Eight were considering something that would put their NFL careers in jeopardy, a boycott.
And let's be clear about this. They all wanted to play. None of them had signed their letters of intent to Syracuse, expecting to sit out. But there was a lot about their Syracuse experience they didn't expect.
It was a short ride from the airport to the university, but that's all it took to educate running back Greg Allen about the realities of being a black football player at Syracuse. Greg was driven to campus by the coach who recruited him.
We get in the car, and we begin, the small talk. Greg, gee, I'm glad you're here. We want you to have a good time while you're at Syracuse. We want you to get a good education. We want you to grow. We want you to have a great career as a football player. But the one thing we're going to ask you to do is not date any white girls while you're here. It was a little bit of a shock for me because I knew that I had traveled north of the Mason-Dixon line, not below it.
And there was more. Alif was a proud alum of Ringe Technical School with a near-perfect math SAT score. He wanted to be an engineer, but
they wouldn't allow me to take a calculus course, a math course, because it was during football practice. And the only option was to take a calculus honors class. And the assumption was, oh, you're a football player. What are you doing over here? And I felt kind of insulted. And it was kind of like, they wanted me to take, like, general reading classes and general education classes. And it was like, wait a minute. No. I didn't come here for that.
Greg Allen was told he couldn't be a biology major because he wouldn't have time for labs. But he says that policy didn't apply to white players. So the Syracuse Eight drafted a petition asking the administration to give black and white players the same access to tutors and academic advisors.
But most of the requests the group hashed out at Ben's Kitchen would benefit both the black and white players. Take the team doctor.
Our medical doctor for our football team was a gynecologist by training.
Alif says the recommendation for every injury was ice and rest. More than that, Greg says the doctor was hesitant to touch black bodies.
There were two sets of latex gloves, and anything that could be avoided was avoided. So, you're at a major university, and at the time, one of the best football programs in the country, and you don't think enough of your players to get them expert medical care.
The next item on the list had to do with playing time. The Big Southern schools still weren't integrated. They wouldn't play against teams with black players. And Dana Harrell says north of the Cotton Curtain, schools followed unofficial rules about how many black players could be on the field at the same time, even at home games.
You could have three outstanding halfbacks, but you wouldn't play them all together because you didn't want the big money boosters. That's what I call them, the big money boosters, to accuse the program of going black.
It's dehumanizing. My talents, my own personal desires and wishes and goals and dreams take a back seat to this thing called race or racism.
The players felt if the team had a black assistant coach, many of these issues would go away. But by the spring of 1970, they'd been asking their coaches to hire a black assistant for a year. It hadn't happened.
Meanwhile, Greg Allen attended a meeting where a group of students and university leaders discussed starting a black studies program at Syracuse. A couple days later, he got a call to meet with head football coach Ben Schwartzwalder.
So I walked into the coach's office and I sat down. And he peered at me over his glasses, and he looked at me, and he said, what's this I hear about you and this black crap?
Greg started to explain his position, but he says the coach really wasn't listening.
So he looked me in the eye, and he said, well, then you have a decision to make. You can't be black and be a football player. Of course, I was a little taken back. I said, well, coach, you know, I'm going to be black all my life. I'm only going to be a football player for a short period of time, but I don't see how one would interfere with the other.
These were the issues Alif and Dana and Greg and the other black players talked about when they met at Ben's Kitchen. By the way, Greg liked it there, too.
Great soul food, so yeah, it was a good place.
For Greg and his teammates, Syracuse University was also a good place. There was no sense in transferring. They felt no other school would have been better or worse, so
we decided to stay and fight for the soul of this great university.
As spring approached, the players decided to appeal to the coach one more time. If they didn't see substantial efforts to address their grievances, they'd walk out of spring practice. Not a game or an alumni event, nothing that would put the program at risk, just spring practice.
When we found out that, you know, the coach really wasn't going to meet our requests, we didn't show up for practice the next day. We knew if we had someone leak it to the press that we would get the attention that we thought we deserved.
The players got that attention, but they soon discovered that they weren't in control of the narrative. The media seized on one of their requests in particular, that the school hire a black assistant coach. The other demands, the ones that would benefit everyone, they were forgotten.
Greg says the papers labeled the Syracuse Eight as black dissidents or black militants or sometimes just the blacks.
We were never asked any questions, or the media never contacted us to get any of our opinions. No one was really interested in our perspective.
The nine members of the Syracuse Eight were suspended from the team, and some of their white teammates threatened to boycott if the black players were allowed back. Soon, Dana says, the chancellor's office was flooded with letters from alumni.
We want them off the team. We want their scholarships revoked. Some of them wanted us out of Syracuse University. They called us everything except a child of God, by the way. And they would put under their signature how much they contribute every year. Some of the fans threatened to boycott the games if we were ever allowed to come back. Well, we heard that before.
Yeah, he's talking about Colin Kaepernick.
And like Colin Kaepernick, the Syracuse Eight had a lot to lose. Each was the first member of his family to go to college, and each was now risking his scholarship to stand up for what he believed in. Once the story hit the papers, Dana Harrell got a call from his father.
Well, the conversation went like this. I went on like a 19, 20-year-old young person would do about, you know, because everything's so clear when you're 19 and 20 years old, about what was right and what was wrong and what I felt I had to do. And he let me get it all out. And he said to me, Dana, when you're 40 years old and have a family and a mortgage and things you want to do for them, you're going to need that college degree. Click.
The players went home for the summer, not knowing what would come of their protest. Would they be allowed back on the team? Would they lose their scholarships?
over the summer, Jim Brown stepped in to help, acting as an intermediary between the players and Coach Schwarzwalder. It didn't work. But on orders from the chancellor, Schwarzwalder did try to find a black assistant coach. Jake Gaither, the head coach at Florida A&M, told Elif,
"You guys don't need a coach. You need a Martin Luther King. I mean, who do you think is going to step into that?" There was a lot of coaches to turn that job down. They knew the deal, and they didn't want to step into that.
When Elif returned to Syracuse in the fall, a black assistant coach had been hired, but
he was not on the program, listed as a coach. I remember going to a meeting, and the coaches were meeting, and the blackboard with X's and O's, and he's sitting in the back of the room with his head down on the desk like he was sleeping. You talk about something that was hurtful. I mean, it was like, wait a minute. I mean, I sacrificed a career. I felt deeply, deeply hurt.
The Syracuse Eight decided to continue their boycott. They sat out the whole season, and the chancellor and a group of faculty members made their own stand. They said,
"These guys will keep their scholarship. You will not mess with their education. All right? They will graduate."
And they did.
I turned that type A focus from sports to academics, and it worked. And it worked. But you sit there squirming on Sunday afternoon watching guys you played with and against. And, you know, they're still having fun. And it takes a while to get it out of your system.
Of the nine, eight graduated from Syracuse University. Four went on to earn master's degrees. Dana Harrell went to law school. Another player completed the coursework for a PhD, but never finished his dissertation.
With the faculty and the chancellor on their side, the Syracuse Eight started seeing changes at the school. But while their academic careers took off, their football careers stalled. After his sophomore season, Greg Allen was contacted by scouts from every NFL team. Then came the boycott. Greg played his senior year at Syracuse, but he didn't hear from a single NFL scout. He ended up in Canada, playing for the CFL. And that's when he discovered how far the influence of the NFL reached.
One day I was asked to come into the coach's office, and I went to see the coach. And he says, "Greg, we're going to have to let you go." And I said, "Let me go? What are you talking about, coach? I'm doing well here, you know. You said I was the best athlete in camp." He said, "Yeah, but you have a little bit too much baggage for us."
Even in that moment, did you have a twinge of regret?
No, it was pure anger. I was angry that I had to go through this only because I decided that institutional racism had no place at Syracuse University or any place else in this world.
The nine members of the Syracuse Eight moved on with their lives. They raised their families and launched successful careers. Dana Harrell moved to the Boston area, where he coached a Pop Warner football team. Elif Muhammad's youngest son was one of his players.
We weren't talking about the Syracuse Eight stuff. It was 36 years ago. Our kids didn't even know anything about it. Nothing.
But back in Syracuse, people had started talking about the events of 1970. Alumni and some of the Syracuse Eight's white teammates lobbied the university to make a formal apology.
And then in 2006, the Syracuse Eight were invited back to receive the Chancellor's Medal, the university's highest honor, and their letterman's jackets, a few sizes larger than they would have been in 1970.
They played Louisville, and it was at halftime. They had us come down.
They had us in the tunnel, and they wanted us, when they called our names, for us to run out of the tunnel like we did in our playing days. And we looked at them like they were crazy. We don't have two good knees between us. But the satisfaction was immeasurable.
And we're nothing but smiles and old men welling up in tears. I almost don't have the words to describe it. It was a cleansing, a lifting of this baggage that I had been carrying around for years, to have someone finally acknowledge that we didn't do this, you know, despite the university or hurt the university. We're trying to make, you know, the university and this world just a better place.
It took 36 years for the Syracuse Eight to meet again on that football field instead of at Ben's Kitchen. 36 years for Syracuse to apologize and recognize the players were on the right side of history. 36 years.
So we asked Dana Harrell, how long before Colin Kaepernick's critics see him in a different light? Will someone someday ask him to run out on a football field in front of a cheering crowd?
I'm going to answer that first with a quote. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Dr. King gave that answer when he was asked, how long did he think it would take for African Americans to get full rights here in America? And, you know, he said, how long?
Not long, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
How long? Not long. So that's my answer.
That's Dana Harrell speaking with Only a Game's Karen Given and Shira Springer. The nine members of the Syracuse Eight were Dana Harrell, Greg Allen, Alif Mohammed, John Loban, Ronald Womack, Clarence McGill, Richard Bulls, John Godbolt, and Dwayne Walker. Their stories are told in the book Leveling the Playing Field, The Story of the Syracuse Eight, and we'll have a link at onlyagame.org. The rules of pickup basketball clearly state that a 5'9 guy in his late 50s doesn't have a chance against a younger, taller, more athletic opponent, right?
I went to the three-point line, and I matched him shot for shot, five in a row. I was in the zone.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Our thanks go out to Melissa Nothing 3, who apparently had a little trouble leaving the following review on Apple Podcasts. This show is interesting, intelligent, funny, poignant. Sometimes I slide the repeat so I can hear Bill Littlefield and Charlie Pierce laugh again. I learn a little about sports, but more about the silliness, dedication, and humanity of the game. And it has taken me three times to write this review because whatever name I pick has been taken, so you know I really like this program. Thanks, Melissa Nothing 3. We appreciate everyone who has left a review of our show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever they get their podcasts. It helps other listeners find our show, and sometimes we get a kick out of the funny names the system makes people choose. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. Last week on this segment, we told you about Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones, who has threatened a lawsuit if NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell's contract is extended. This week, we learned that Goodell is asking for about $49 million a year, as well as health care for life, as well as the use of a private jet, also for life. That's up first this week. I'm joined by SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder and Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Bill. Thrilled to be here, as always.
Mike, take it away.
I am just enraptured by the Roger Goodell v. Jerry Jones storyline. No matter what these guys do for each other, there's that scene in the movie, what is it, 10,000 years BC, where our protagonists are watching the Tyrannosaurus fight the Stegosaurus. Like, is there really any loser in this fight? I think all Jerry Jones wants to do is to say, you know, Roger Goodell, maybe you should at least have to work and suffer for your estimated $50 million payday. Because I don't know if you've noticed this, but the NFL has had a pretty terrible year this year, and I'm going to blame you. There's something called the Compensation Committee, which is, in Goodell's case, a little bit of the overcompensation committee, in my opinion. And Jerry Jones is an ad hoc member of the Compensation Committee. I've got to list that on my LinkedIn profile from now on. I love that title. And he just came in and said, ratings are down. You haven't handled the off-field controversies well, although one could argue Jones has exacerbated them. And therefore, we're not going to give you exactly the gigantic mountain of cash you have been used to.
I'm obsessed with this story. I mean, it's Shakespearean. You know, it's almost the father, the son, the loyalties, workers versus the man. I mean, I can't believe everything that's coming out. And some of the things that Jones has said have been totally foul. I mean, I'm not going to say him on NPR, but the man has a mouth on him.
We got the Stegosaurus against the Tyrannosaurus Rex, and we got Shakespeare spinning in his grave because for him to be invoked in this is just...
Sorry, Willie.
I have a different literary reference that comes to mind. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald is alleged to have said to Ernest Hemingway, "The rich are different from you and I." Hemingway said, "Yeah, they have more money." But if that were to transpire today, Hemingway could say, "Yeah, if they don't already have a private jet, they want one."
Oh my God, it is astonishing.
Yeah. Just the amount of stuff and money that's involved in this. Mike, is it going to end, or is this something that's going to last at least through the Super Bowl?
I think what the upshot will be is that Goodell will get his money, will have suffered a little and have lost a little face. And if anyone knows about losing face, it's Jerry Jones. He's only had the current face for the last like 8 or 9 years.
Wow.
I do want to note, though, the advanced ask is not for a private jet. It's for the use of a private jet. And the reason that's important is if you ask for a private jet in 10, 15 years, that jet can get outmoded. But he asked for use of a private jet. You're always going to be riding in a brand new jet.
I'm going to go to Vox and say, "Hello, I would like a private jet for life," and see
ask.
How.
Definitely
see
ask.
How that
yeah.
You never make the shots you don't take. Right, Charlotte?
There you go. Shoot or shoot.
Right. Speaking of which, tell us about the basketball team that's got you excited this year.
Oh, boy. I would like to do nothing more than gush about the Celtics for a little bit, which is what I'm about to do. So the start of the season, Gordon Hayward suffers this absolutely atrocious injury. And so I was really worried about this team, which I was so excited about, having gotten Kyrie and Hayward in the offseason. But it was a rough start, and it's turned into the most incredible story because after losing their first two games, the Celtics have won 14 in a row as of Friday when they beat the Golden State Warriors. If you don't follow basketball, that is the biggest win you can get, especially without one of your star players. They were down 17 at one point, the Celtics were, and I was thinking, you know, of course the Warriors, you come up against them and they're unstoppable. But in the back of my head, I was kind of like, I think they might be able to do it. And then they did it. They won. And I was just ecstatic. They're fun, they're young, they're exciting, and I have just been absolutely glued to these games as though they were playoffs.
Mike, do you share Charlotte's enthusiasm for the Celtics at this point?
Yes, because of what they've overcome, but also because of that word she used, fun. It was the Warriors who were playing the joyous brand of basketball the last couple of years. But, you know, they started off their season, I think, 2-3, and they look like they had some issues, and they haven't been having as much fun. I saw that game. They were grousing at all the officials' calls. The Celtics, a team before the year who were supposed to vie with Cleveland for the Eastern Championship, now they're clearly better than Cleveland. So it upends the normal order of things, which is, I guess that's what the Warriors did. They put together this super team. The question was, can they ever be stopped? It seemed no. Let's not write them off yet. But man, do they have a worthy rival in the East. This is going to be great.
I think you're right. I think it is going to be great. And as somebody who's lived in Boston for a good long time, you know, it was the Cubs last year. It was the Astros last month. It's about time the Boston Celtics won a championship.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Wow. Don't let people outside.
Celtics.
Don't let people outside the Boston market hear this.
I knew the groans would come. But it's my turn. And I learned this week that U.S. soccer is apparently thinking about hosting a men's tournament that would involve, among others, four-time World Cup winner Italy, former World Cup runner-up Holland, Chile, Ghana, Ireland, and Wales. None of these teams will have anything else to do come the summer because they were not among the 32 that qualified for the World Cup final in Russia. Some people have called this idea the Alternative Facts World Cup, which I think is actually pretty funny. I think staging this tournament is a terrific idea. Some people might say, oh, come on, they're thumbing their noses at FIFA, which also I think is a pretty good idea. It would be especially fun if Wales were to win the thing, as far as I'm concerned. Charlotte, what do you think? A seat in the first row for you for the Alternative Facts tournament?
Yeah, you know what? Why not? At this point, that's what we deserve in 2017. It's going to be in Russia, and the U.S. isn't going to be there. And sure, sign me up for the Alternative Facts tournament. I will probably root for Wales also, because how funny would that be? But man, God, way to really screw it up, America.
Mike, do you feel A, let down by the U.S. in failing to make the World Cup, or perhaps B, hey, it's okay, Italy didn't make it either?
Yeah, I definitely feel let down by the United States play, and Italy's failure doesn't give me much solace. I like this. I like this idea. When I first heard about it, I'm like, oh, it's just some fake Russian bots putting forth this idea to embarrass us again. But even the Russians know you don't do that with something as serious as soccer. The teams mm-hmm. that you named, Europe has too many good teams. And Italy is the highest profile one, but the Netherlands are good. And poor Wales. I mean, the Welsh have, because they don't play with the English soccer team, you know, when's the last time Wales could actually think of throwing a team into the World Cup? So I think this gives a lot of good mid-tier teams a chance to be a little bit on the stage. And because, as an American, we'll be watching the Americans, I absolutely look forward to this.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder and Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Mike, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And Charlotte, a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. This is always a blast.
Howard Peretz, a longtime recreational tennis and basketball player, describes himself as just an old-school sports junkie. But that's not the whole story. Howard Peretz had a long career with Hasbro, the toy company.
Well, I think the one that I most identified with was G.I. Joe.
You remember G.I. Joe, right?
G.I. Joe, G.I. Joe, fighting man from end to coast.
Now, a new world of fun with G.I. Joe Action Soldiers of the World.
But I've been involved with Star Wars and Care Bears and Strawberry Shortcake and Ninja Turtles and Pokemon.
Quite a roster, isn't it? So perhaps it's not surprising that, as Howard Peretz saw it, the road should go on forever and the party should never end.
I never really thought about retiring, and I didn't want to get old gracefully and play old man's tennis and bridge and shuffleboard.
Unhappily, age happened to Mr. Peretz, as did orbital cancer, which he became aware of one day when he rushed to the net and lost sight of the tennis ball he'd intended to hit. So he did what any old-school sports junkie benched by circumstances might do. He put together a proposal for a book about great moments in sports. At least one publisher was intrigued, but there was a catch.
They asked me to write the book.
Actually, Howard was okay with that. But the publishing deal fell through. Howard wrote the book anyway. He called it The Book of Sports Miracles and published it himself. He was especially happy to include among the book's 250 alleged miracles the ones he'd witnessed in person, such as the so-called greatest game ever played. The date was December 28, 1958. The Baltimore Colts and Howard's New York Giants met to determine the NFL championship 9 years before the birth of the Super Bowl.
Unitas has been sensational here this afternoon.
At the open end of Yankee Stadium, where the bleachers were, where I was sitting, it was so cold that fans were setting fire to the wooden bleachers.
Unitas takes. He gives to Amici, and the ball game is over. Alan Amici has scored the touchdown, and the Baltimore Colts.
And then I had to watch Alan the Horse Amici go in the end zone right in front of me to win the game. And I'm still mad that the Giants lost the game.
Howard Peretz has ranked that game at number 4 among greatest NFL finishes. It sounds as if it might rank number 1 on a list of the most disappointing of those finishes, at least for a New Yorker like Mr. Peretz. The greatest game ever played is a good story, maybe even a great one, but my favorite among the stories Howard Peretz told me didn't make the book, even though it stars the guy who wrote it.
I went to the Reebok Center as a guest in West Side of Manhattan to play hoops. I had a guest pass. I was in my late 50s. 5'9", headband, could shoot real well, but couldn't run the court, couldn't jump.
As anyone who's played pickup basketball knows, even with a guest pass, Howard Peretz couldn't just walk on to a team. He had to compete for a spot with the other guys on the floor. That competition often means foul shots. Guys who miss them drop out, and the other players keep shooting until there are only five left, and those five play against the team that's held the floor by winning the previous game.
So came down to me and this very athletic, tall African-American who could dunk with either hand, could shoot with his back to the basket, who had great range. Came down to me and him for the fifth spot to play. And, of course, the four guys waiting, they didn't want me. They wanted him because they knew I was a liability. So the guy looked at me. And he's a very classy guy, and he said, you know what, I'm not going to the foul line. I'll go to the three-point line and give this guy a chance.
There, at the three-point line, one of Howard's miracles began to grow wings.
I went to the three-point line, and I matched him shot for shot, five in a row. I was in the zone, and then he missed the sixth shot. And by that time, the crowd, believe it or not, was rooting for me. And they all were yelling for me to go to the foul line because that was the way to win the deal. I was a good foul shooter. But I wouldn't have any of that. I went to the three-point line. I missed the shot. He then made the three. I missed the three, and I never played.
You missed the opportunity to be in your own sports miracle.
My own sports miracle would not make the top 250.
So Howard Peretz didn't get into that pickup game a couple of decades ago at the Reebok Center, but he got a story out of how he almost did. This 5'9 guy in his late 50s wearing a headband almost got to play. It would be years before it would occur to Howard Peretz to collect sports miracles and put them in a book, which, come to think of it, might not ever have happened if he hadn't had to compensate for missing that three-pointer in the gym that day. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of a high school football team that lost 80 games in a row.
When we first got here, we'd have kids that they wouldn't even wear their letter jackets because they would get ridiculed by the other students.
That's just ahead, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Some things in Boston are sacred, like clam chowder and cold weather. But nothing in New England brings out the passion and the fans like our teams. And the fans expect a lot from their teams and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper, and I'm teaming up with WBUR, Boston's NPR station, to bring you a new daily sports podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look, from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available now in Apple Podcasts and wherever you download your podcasts. Brought to you by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, some terrific stories that you missed because there wasn't room for them on our table. Thanksgiving leftovers, anyone? But right now it's time for my conversation about this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Cleveland Cavaliers were off to a less than impressive start this season, but they have rallied lately. How do they explain their improvement on the road?
Sleep, Bill. Oh. And I find that as a solution to many of the problems on the long and winding road of life. They're staying over after games. They're not climbing on the charter jet and flying. And I never thought that made any sense, especially with the surreal way the NBA puts the schedule together.
I have this image of the aging Cavaliers going out to restaurants for the early bird special and watching Murder, She Wrote episodes when they do
Matlock,
get on the
phone. Matlock!
I don't know if you still harbor dreams of an NBA career, Charlie. I have seen you shoot on the court outside my house, and such dreams, I think, would be entirely,
misplaced. Go ahead.
I was going to say reasonable.
Oh,
but anyway,
you.
Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors is holding online basketball classes. Can we sign you up?
Well, yeah. I mean, apparently this is not online how to put together a zone defense. This is online how to play the game, how to dribble the ball, how to shoot like Steph Curry. I did take a basketball course at Marquette taught by assistant coach Hank Raymonds called Theory and Coaching of Basketball.
I bet it was fun.
It was hilarious.
And you probably had some excellent classmates.
I did, actually. Several of them, made a profession of it, strangely enough.
Some of them quite tall. UCLA basketball players LiAngelo Ball, Cody Riley, and Jalen Hill, referred to by President Trump as knuckleheads, according to his chief of staff, have returned from China, where they had been arrested for shoplifting. They've thanked the president for facilitating their release. So is this story over?
No, but I'll tell you one thing. If there's anybody on earth that deserves to be badgered by LeVar Ball, it's the current president of the United States. I don't care how grateful LeVar is, they're going to be sick of him. But I do appreciate the president telling these three miscreants that there are many pitfalls on the long and winding road of life. He's writing his own stuff again.
Or stealing
or sampling his own stuff again. Who knows?
NASCAR's final race of 2017 takes place this weekend at Homestead Miami Speedway. You got a favorite in that one?
I would kind of like to see Dale Earnhardt Jr. win because it's his last race. He's taken himself out of the profession after this. I think if I had to make a Mr. NASCAR wager on it, I'd go with Brad Keselowski.
But it is, as you say, Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s final race.
And the last Earnhardt.
It'll be emotional.
Yeah, it will be. And people have sort of forgotten that Dale Earnhardt Jr. is the third generation of Earnhardts. Mm. The dynastic element of NASCAR is often overlooked. Fathers and sons and grandfathers all raced together, and even Richard Petty's father raced. So there's a lot going out of the sport without an Earnhardt.
How many of those grandfathers raced with a trunk full of moonshine?
Well, at the beginning, Bill, before they professionalized it.
Major League Baseball's MVP voting is in, and the Astros' Jose Altuve is the American League winner, and the Marlins' Giancarlo Stanton, the MVP of the National League. I really think this Altuve thing was easy. If he hadn't won, everybody else is tied for 10th, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, I agree. Normal-sized Americans would have rioted. Are you kidding? I mean, he's just such a wonderfully charismatic player, and he had such a great year, and they won the World Championship. I was interested that Aaron Judge came in second, though, mm-hmm. which is remarkably close.
And suggests that the Yankees will be a force to be reckoned with going
forward.
Yes,
very much so.
By managing only to tie Sweden on Monday night, the Italian men's soccer team saved itself a trip to Russia. four times Italy has won the World Cup. They're not going to be present at the festivities, but please tell me the tournament's going to go on anyway.
Well, because the Icelanders are there, and they are now my adopted team, Bill.
Okay.
We will smite them. We'll smite them with the power of the hammer Mjolnir.
Says so right on the Twitter feed.
That's right. Right on the Reykjavik Gazette Twitter feed. Absolutely.
Peru qualified for the 2018 World Cup with a 2-0 win over New Zealand on Wednesday, and the excitement of its fans was palpable, measurable even.
Apparently it actually registered on seismographs, which I think would scare the hell out of me if I were in Peru, to be perfectly honest with you. Good for Peru. They haven't been in a while. It's just bizarre to me that they were playing their traditional rivals, New Zealand, to get there.
And finally, Charlie, Thomas Golisano, former owner of the NHL's Buffalo Sabres and husband of former tennis star Monica Seles, went to court this week, and it wasn't a tennis court, though his wife was involved in the story. Something to do with her contention that there are too many pillows on their yacht. Help me out with this.
You know, there are first world problems, and then there are first world problems.
Too many pillows.
And then there's Thomas Golisano and his wife, Monica Seles, who are suing an interior decorator because she overcharged them more than $300,000 when she renovated their yacht. Mm. And one of the complaints was there were so many pillows on the couch that Monica Seles couldn't sit on it. I have a great idea. Move the damn pillows.
Move a few of them aside.
I mean, are they sewn into the couch?
I know a dog who sometimes has that problem, and she simply eats the stuffing
there
out of the
go.
Pillows and then sits down.
Hire someone to move the pillows.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Everyone wants to be a winner, but somebody has to lose. But nobody should have to go through what Michael Porter went through. Here's reporter King Kaufman.
Takes the snap.
When he was at Jefferson Davis High School in Houston, Mike Porter was a pretty good football player.
He was good. He was a hard-nosed running back and get short yardage, good yardage. He could run inside or outside.
Chuck Arnold was a rookie head coach Porter's senior year, 1991. And when you're a new coach, it's nice to have a good player. The thing is, it's even nicer to have more than one.
We used him for everything. We put him at tailback.
That's assistant coach Gerald Garcia.
We put him at any place we needed him that week. We did the scouting, and whatever their strength was, we'd plug Michael in there. I mean, if they had a big-time receiver and all they threw was through it, Michael played corner that week.
There were two seniors, two juniors, and the rest were freshmen. So we took a beating that first year. I mean, we scored three touchdowns, and Mike had all of them. So it was a rough year.
Davis High, it's called Northside now, was 6 years into what would become the longest losing streak in high school football history, and there was no end in sight. The cumulative score that year? Other guys, 437. Davis, 22.
Man, you just wanted to win, man. I mean...
That's Mike Porter, the hard-nosed running back who played wherever they needed him to.
Goodness, you come back to class and some kid sitting in the class would make a joke about it and... I had to learn to ignore that.
When we first got here, we'd have kids that they wouldn't even wear their letter jackets because they would get ridiculed by the other students.
We passed out T-shirts with Jeff Davis football, and you'd see kids wear them inside out.
These are the players.
Yeah, that was the players.
How'd it get so bad? The school's in a working-class area just north of downtown Houston. For a long time, Davis was just like a lot of other big city high schools, in Texas and elsewhere. They played some football, they had some good years, they had some bad years. And then in the 70s, things started to go downhill. Budget cuts, poverty, white flight. By the early 90s, the facilities were dilapidated and most of the best players had found their way to other schools. Here's Coach Garcia again.
If you know football, you got to have an army, and we were running out there with 15, 16 kids trying to play 5A football.
The losing streak started in the middle of the 1985 season, and when Mike Porter made the team, it was in the 30s. By the end of his junior year, the Panthers had lost 54 straight. They were looking for a new head coach. It's hard to believe, but not a lot of people wanted that job. Chuck Arnold did.
You know, one of my goals was to be a head coach, and there weren't that many of them popping up, so, you know, I took the chance when I had it. I knew it was a one-time deal, either change the program or I'd never get another shot. It's that kind of deal.
For Mike Porter, it wasn't all bad.
You know, as a student and as an athlete, it was great for me. I mean, it was a life skill kid, and, you know, that's some form of special education. Every game, this kid would come up to me, like on Monday or Tuesday, and was like, good game, Mike. And man, it's like I tell you, seriously, he couldn't play. And I'm sure he wanted to. But I got the opportunity to play. So I wanted to play for him. Because win, lose, or draw, he was always like that. So, you know, that's what I did. But we didn't win. And it was tough.
After losing every high school game he ever appeared in, Porter played his college ball at Prairie View A&M, just outside of Houston, and the losing continued. In the aftermath of yet another tough day on the field, he got some news.
I was on a bus driving back to Houston. I believe we had lost to Alabama State. I don't know. The O-line coach, he got a newspaper, and he was like, hey, Porter, your school won.
After a record 80 straight losses, Davis had finally won. A 1918 squeaker over Wheatley. The win hadn't just made the front page of the Houston Chronicle. It was national news.
Man, I just felt really good. And I was like, oh, hell, we just lost. But, you know, I was just really happy.
No jealousy?
Well, almost immediately I thought, oh, man, they're going to start looking at us more. And they're going to find me.
Why'd they want to find him? Because it was 1993, and the Prairie View A&M Panthers hadn't won since 1989. Yeah, Prairie View A&M, also the Panthers. They were on their way to losing, you're going to think I'm making this up, 80 straight games. Exactly the same number as Davis High. It's an NCAA record by a lot. The second longest streak is 44.
I just stopped looking at scoreboards that much. You know, we still hang out. We don't talk about it. We like to talk about, we say, you know what, we didn't win a game, but we kicked it like national champions.
Michael Porter's football career came to an end in 1996. His combined high school and college record as a player was 0-77. Back at Davis High, Chuck Arnold was looking for an assistant coach. He gave Porter a call.
He dealt with the adversity that we'd gone through there, and we were still going through it a little bit. So I knew he could handle it, where a lot of people avoid the losing stigma completely. It was hard to find good coaches.
Porter was the offensive coordinator for the Panthers in 2008 when they went undefeated in the regular season and they made it to the second round of the state playoffs. And when Chuck Arnold retired in 2013, Porter took over as head coach. The job was a little more attractive this time around. Maybe all that losing as a player taught him a little something about how to coach.
Well, it definitely shapes you. You learn more from losing than winning, of course. I mean, you build character, as they all say. Yeah, well, I've had enough character building. And Mike has, too.
Michael Porter did not have to wait 8 years or 80 games to get his first win as a head coach, but it didn't come easy. His Panthers lost their first five, and then they beat Austin 31-20.
I mean, I think I jumped up in the air about 5 feet or something. But it was wonderful feeling. We played a really good game. We win. Oh, it was awesome, man. It was, it just felt like everybody was with me.
When I go talk to your kids and I say, what does Coach Porter say about the losing streak? What are they going to roll their eyes and say, oh, man, he talks about this all the time. Here's what he says. What is it?
Well, amazingly, we don't talk about it much. These kids weren't born.
You never hear any of him talking about himself.
Most of the time after practice, team meetings, in mid-game.
Jamichael Jordan's a junior defensive tackle, and Patrick Brown's a running back who graduated last year. Here's Patrick again.
Yeah, he mentions it, especially when we're down and team always say, man, we stay losing and stuff like that. He said, I know, I've been through it. Just pick your head back up.
Back in my day, I played a part of the team that had the 80-something game losing streak. And I know what it was like, just all kind of stuff like that.
Do you ever get tired of hearing about it?
No, sir, because it encouraged me. Like, I don't want to be like Coach Porter. I want to win.
And you guys told me that you make fun of him, not about the streak, just for being him.
He got these little phrases he says like, Man, y'all talking about man. He talks funny, and we always just be laughing and stuff in the huddle.
The 2017 season just ended for the Northside Panthers, formerly Jefferson Davis High. It was a tough one, starting with Hurricane Harvey. The neighborhood escaped the worst of the damage, but it was still hit pretty hard. The football schedule got reduced from 10 games to 8, and the Panthers were young, and they battled injuries. But Porter says their enthusiasm never waned.
I just hadn't felt like I had a complete team. But, I mean, kids compete. They're proud to play. It ain't the old days where I'm hiding my shirt. You know, they go out and compete.
S-P-I-R-I-T, spirit, we got spirit. We got it.
The Panthers got blown out several times on their way to a 2-6 record. But they've got a coach who knows how to deal with that sort of thing.
I don't know where I would be without that streak. I mean, it made me a stronger person. I genuinely believe that. You know, it's rough to have to go through that. But, you know, if you do, don't worry. They ain't going to last forever. I don't feel like I'm still losing.
That's high school football coach Michael Porter speaking with reporter King Kaufman. A longer version of this story and other stories about losing appear on King's podcast, Can't Win for Losing. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Brian Bouchard. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Dana Harrell, who offers the following restaurant review of the late, great Ben's Kitchen.
Be quite honest with you, it was some of the best soul food I ever had, but you wouldn't want to take a bacteria count in there?
Hey, how high could the count have been? You live to tell the tale, right? I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.